Welcome to the April 24th, 2026 Santa Ana Water, Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. We are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcasted and recorded. For those of you who have completed a virtual speaker card for this Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you're done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera will be turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting. For people who only want to listen or to watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. So, I'm first of all going to ask the board members to introduce themselves, beginning with Board Member Lopez.
Hello, my name is Al Lopez. I am the former mayor, council member, City of Corona, and also a past board member of Western Municipal Water District in Riverside County.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday. Leticia Clark from the great city of Tustin. Good to be with you.
Okay, and then Board Member Rue.
Yes, I'm Bill Rue. I am coming to you virtually. I am a council member in the city of Montclair, and many, many years ago, a board member for the Monte Vista Water District. Thank you.
And our vice chair.
Good morning, everyone. Gloria Alvarado, resident of the city of Santa Ana. Thank you for having us.
And I'm John Scandura. I'm chair of this water board. We are meeting from the Irvine Ranch Water Districts in Irvine, not very far from where I went to school a long time ago. So, we do have a quorum. A majority of the board is here here with us in person. Board Member Rue is participating remotely. The Open Meeting Act requires board members who are participating remotely to disclose if there are any other individuals 18 years or older present in the same room. And if so,
no, there is not.
So there aren't any. Thank you. The Open Meeting Act also requires remote board members must remain on camera for the entire portion of the meeting that is publicly accessible via the internet. If a board member needs to turn off their camera during the open portion of the meeting, they must announce their reason for doing so, so that council can advise whether an exception to the on-camera rule applies. So, we now go to our public forum. We welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request for those items listed on today's agenda. You will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. So if you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments are limited to 3 minutes. So Jessica, do we have any speaker cards for the forum?
No, we do not.
Okay. Thank you. All right, our next item is our State Water Resources Control Board Liaison Report, and I would like to introduce to you the Vice Chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, Doreen Diadamo, who will provide an update.
Good morning, Chair and members of the board. Welcome you all to Irvine, and good to see you. I have quite a lengthy report, so I'm gonna go as quickly as I can. So that you can move on to the rest of your agenda. And please, as always, feel free to ask any questions at the conclusion. So I'll start off with some items that some of you requested the last time I appeared before you, starting with an update on the Colorado River. Most of these issues, the vast majority of the discussions are going on through the Department of Interior. So this is something that we're not as engaged in, but we do receive periodic updates at the state board. Last Friday, the Department of Interior announced that it is preparing to take actions in an effort to head off a water and power crisis on the Colorado River system. Long-term drought combined with the lowest snowpack on record has reduced the Colorado River system storage to just 36% of capacity. The Department of Interior announced that it will be taking emergency action to reduce releases out of Lake Powell to the minimum amounts legally allowed in order to prevent water levels from reaching levels that could cause damage to the infrastructure for water supply and hydropower generation. A final decision is expected soon. Speaking of the interesting year that we've had here with respect to snowpack, similar over in the Sierra Nevada as well. The Department of Water Resources annual snow survey highlighted that we're also seeing a what's called a snowpack drought. Normally, snowpack actually peaks in April, and so there's a snow survey in the Sierra Nevadas at that time. But instead of peaking, it dropped down to just 18% on the April 1st date, 18% of average. The only lower level was during the drought in 2015, which was a 0% snowpack. So, of course, with climate change, we expect to be seeing these situations more frequently. This was then following a dry March and intense record-breaking temperatures. This is what led to the situation. Now, while the winter storms did provide for a strong start in January, the snowpack melted rapidly. Despite the low snowpack, major California reservoirs remain in decent condition due to previous year's high precipitation. April storms, the most recent storms that we've received, have provided some relief, but not enough to reverse that early onset of the snow melt and the snow deficit. I was also asked to report on an update of waters of the United States. Our board is tracking a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and U.S. EPA proposal that would change the definition of waters of the United States, affecting the scope of the Clean Water Act. This definition would more narrowly define waters subject to the Clean Water Act and would introduce new terms, creating additional uncertainty in implementation. If finalized, the boards would need to rely, as we are already doing as a result of the Sackett decision, we would need to rely on our authorities under Porter Cologne to protect water quality. This would essentially further exacerbate the challenges that we're seeing with resources and additional workload, in particular, facing you all at the regional board level. Public comment closed on January 5th, so we do expect to receive an update on this soon with respect to a determination of a final rulemaking. Okay, moving on. It's been a busy April for us at the State Board. At our April 7th meeting, we continued our discussion regarding our annual priorities, as well as an update to our strategic work plan. We've created a new category for priority programs. And so essentially what we're looking to do is really focus our strategic work plan on actions that we expect to take this year, this calendar year. But there remains really top priorities for us, even if we're not going to take any high-level action. A good example of this would be the Safe Drinking Water Program. So even if we don't undertake a significant action this year as a board, it continues to be a top priority for our board, and as we know, for all of the water boards. We also have had a fair amount of activity under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. On April 7th, we approved a resolution to refer the Delta Mendota Groundwater Subbasin. This is a subbasin on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, referring it back to the Department of Water Resources for continued evaluation and assessment as to implementation of the basin's coordinated plan. Our staff provided for an assessment on the updated plan that provided for coordination within this large subbasin, and we found as a board that they made significant progress towards sustainability. So rather than developing an interim plan and continuing to have the basin on probation, we felt that it was appropriate to send them back to the Department of Water Resources, where they will continue to assess implementation, not just development of the plan, but implementation of the plan. I think this really speaks to the good work that's being done at the local level in these groundwater basins that initially were referred to our board, but we've referred back to the Department of Water Resources a number of them. I think that this is the fifth basin that we've referred back. But then there are some basins where we continue to see challenges, the Tulare Lake Basin and the Tule Basin. On April 7th, our board felt that it was appropriate to look at an exclusion from fees. The fees will begin to take effect on May 1st in these two basins, and also reportings of extractions. And we felt that it was important to provide for relief for small farms where no more than 20 acre feet are extracted. And they do not extract from wells, excuse me, within 2 miles of the Fry and Kern Canal, where we've seen a significant subsidence. And so we approved that recommendation from staff at the April 7th meeting. This last board meeting on Tuesday, we received requests for additional exclusions from fees from 8 groundwater sustainability agencies within the Tule Basin. Our staff spent a lot of time evaluating updated plans and did find that there was significant improvement, however, not enough to show how the basin would be in sustainability within the timeframes outlined in the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. So we did reject these requests and inform the groundwater sustainability agencies that we will be sending out invoices in May for those fees. At the same time, though, this was, you know, very disappointing for those agencies. But at the same time, our board was very clear in our commitment that we will move forward with the development of interim plans in these two basins. But it is our strong desire that the local groundwater sustainability agencies improve their coordination throughout the basin and submit updated plans prior to our adoption of an interim plan. So what we're hoping to do is, in parallel, encourage the basins to develop an updated plan as we develop an interim plan, and spend a lot more time in those basins as well, communicating and working through the remaining technical challenges that those basins face. All right, moving on to Sites Reservoir, the Administrative Hearings Office has prepared and released on behalf of our board a draft decision and an associated draft water right permit on the petition for the assignment of a state-filed application and accompanying water right application for the Sites Reservoir project. This is open to public comment, this decision, and you don't have to be a party to comment. This is open to the public. The comment period closes on May 22nd, and the draft permit and decision documents are posted on the website for the Administrative Hearings Office. The Administrative Hearings Office will also be continuing its work with our board, following closely the Delta Conveyance Project. The protestants to this petition we're in the phase of the rebuttal portion for the protestants. And the hearing will begin in June. And I note that there are hearing dates posted throughout the month of June. More information can be found on the project webpage, and you can follow those proceedings on the YouTube channel. Mono Lake, our board held an information item in March on the 17th regarding Mono Lake levels. Our staff commissioned UCLA as a contractor to provide modeling information regarding lake levels under various scenarios, including under climate change scenarios. At that workshop, it was quite informative, but it got very technical. And so we felt that it was important to have additional opportunity to look at models, including from the LA Department of Water, and staff plans to hold one or more public workshop this year to collect information on the condition of Mono Lake's basins, public trust resources, and to evaluate potential management actions that could get them to the lake level that was provided for in the Mono Lake decision from 1994. Okay, on March 30th, our board released a draft report on recommendations of the second statewide agricultural expert panel. And this is with respect to the irrigated lands regulatory program and possible adjustments that we may want to consider, either as a state board or regional boards. The comments are due on the draft April 30th. There have been several workshops for folks to comment publicly, and we do expect that the expert panel will be collecting those comments and then holding additional meetings in which they'll be deliberating in public, likely to be two sessions. So stay tuned for when those sessions will take place. After we receive a final report, I expect that we'll be receiving an information item to assess next steps. Moving on to the integrated report, on March 3rd, our staff released the 2026 California Integrated Report final documents and summary of comments and responses on the program webpage. Staff is now scheduled to distribute a notice announcing solicitation of surface water quality data and information to inform the completion of the next integrated report for 2030. The solicitation notice will provide data and information solicitation cutoff date expected to be in August of this year, focusing on surface water bodies in the following regional board locations: San Francisco, Los Angeles, this region, Santa Ana, and the Sacramento River sub-area of the Central Valley region. Our board is accepting public comments on the proposed emergency regulations for electronic reporting of drinking water quality. And the comments are due April 30th, and we are expected to consider adoption of these emergency regulations at our June 2nd board meeting. Staff is kicking off the annual process for the consideration of the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Program's intended use plans as to how the funds would be distributed in this fiscal year. The intended use plan outlines our plan for administering the Clean Water and Drinking Water SRF programs and associated finance programs for this fiscal year, and plan to release the draft soon on April 27th, and a board workshop to receive public comments is tentatively planned for May 19th. Our staff held a stakeholder meeting this week on Wednesday to discuss possible changes to the fiscal year water quality certification fees, looking for options and comments as to how the fee schedule could be structured in a more equitable way, distributing among the projects that we are considering for water quality certification, taking into consideration complexity of the projects and amount of time that would be involved, and providing for some fee relief for those projects that are not as complex. Today, we have a wastewater needs assessment advisory group. The advisory group began meeting in July of 2024, and we're really excited about this project. The drinking water needs assessment has just been crucial in us making, I think, better decisions on distribution of funds for the drinking water state revolving fund program and the safer additional funds that we receive. And we're looking to do something similar with the Clean Water Program. And through this advisory group, we are currently in, they're currently considering phase two of the project, which is focusing on mapping tools as to systems that are inadequate, additional information on analysis of needs, costs to meet the needs, and available funding and funding gaps. So this, I think, will be a really important tool for all of the water boards as we move forward with sanitation needs for the state. And then lastly, just reminding everyone that we have our annual Water Quality Coordinating Committee coming up soon here in Sacramento on the 14th and 15th. And I am looking here. I was just wanting to double check. I believe that remote opportunities are available. Yes. And I just checked with my staff and they said yes. So hopefully you'll be able to attend. And for those of you who aren't able to attend, please do join us remotely if you're able to. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Vice Chair, and amazing report. It's amazing to see how much work both your board and the staff up there are doing these days. So, board members, do you have any questions or comments? Do I see any? Okay. Board Member Clark.
Thank you for that informative report. Just a quick question. I had a note about the exclusion of fees for those small farms. Was there a time limit on how long the fees will be?
Well, the fees will continue as long as the basin is subject to our board's authority. A little bit of background on these fees. We did hear from a number of small farms. In particular, the focus really was on racial equity. We did hear from, in particular, Punjabi farmers and concerns about ability to provide electronic reports mm-hmm. and to get up to speed to the program. Because these are truly minimal extractions, there's a number of small farms, but by volume, we're talking about 4% by volume. So the vast majority of the volume is really on the larger farms. Mm-hmm. And we felt that it was important to go ahead and provide for this relief because of equity issues, and also because in order to enforce against these smaller farms, it would really take up a lot of our resources. And so because we're a fee-based program, this is something that we felt that was appropriate. As I said, we're really trying to get the basin to submit updated plans. These small farms will remain in probation. They'll just be excluded from the need to report their extractions.
Gotcha. Okay, great. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. And Board Member Rue, do you have any questions or comments?
Yes. For the WQCC, if I can be sent a link, I will try to participate remotely. I do have both days fairly full with meetings with some legislators down here. So I can try to do that in between. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's always good to have your participation. Thank you, board member.
Okay. And my comments, thank you for the very, very thorough, very extensive report on the water situation. It just shows how complicated our water situation is, that even though it seems like we get a lot of rain, it doesn't always translate to plenty of water out there. And then a little bit later on, we're going to have a presentation on dredge and fill permits, and that's impacted by the decisions of the waters of the United States. And believe me, our purview seems to keep expanding and expanding and expanding along with our resource needs there. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next month at the WQCC meeting.
Yes, thank you. Good to see you all. Have a productive meeting.
Thank you. Okay, our next item is an action item for the approval of the meeting minutes for the March 13th, 2026 meeting. Do I have a motion?
I will make a motion.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. And Jessica, could we have a roll call vote?
Bortnander Lopez.
Aye.
Bortnander Clark.
Aye.
Bortnander Rue.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
Aye.
Chair Scandora.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. Our next item is the consideration of the consent calendar, which is listed as items 6 and 7. I do note that for item 6, any kind of motion for approval, either for the consent calendar or the specific item, must include changes that are shown in an errata sheet that's provided to all of you in today's meeting. And at this time, I ask if there are any interested persons or board member requests to remove this consent calendar item. Seeing none.
I will make a motion for the consent calendar as presented.
Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. Jessica, could we have a roll call vote?
Bortnander Lopez?
Aye.
Bortnander Clark?
Aye.
Bortnander Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
Aye.
Chair Scandora?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next item is item 8, which is assessing the administrative civil liability in the Wicked Creations Incorporated case that we took up at our last meeting. And so I'd like to ask our attorney, our advisory team counsel, Heraclio Pimentel, to present this item.
Thank you, Chair Scandura. On March 13, 2026, the Santa Ana Water Board held a public hearing on administrative civil liability complaint number R8-2025-0066 against respondent Wicked Creations, Inc. After considering the evidence received at the hearing, the board found respondent liable for the violation alleged in the complaint and decided to assess the respondent's civil liability in the amount of $150,000 plus staff cost of $4,603 for a total liability of $154,603. Upon issuing its determination, the board directed the advisory team to conform the prosecution team's proposed order to the board's determination and the evidence received at the hearing, and present such order for consideration and adoption at this board meeting. Accordingly, presented today for the board's consideration is adoption of Administrative Civil Liability Order number R8-2025-0066, assessing administrative civil liability in the matter of Wicked Creations, Inc. And with that, I return item 8 to the chair. The advisory team is available for any questions.
Okay. Well, thank you, Council. And board members, do we have any questions for the advisory team or any comments? Board Member Rue? Okay. And Jessica, are there any speaker cards for this item?
No, there are no speaker cards.
Okay. Thought we lost Board Member Rue there for a second. Okay. Do we have a motion and a second?
So move.
I'll second.
Okay. Item's been moved and seconded. And Jessica, could we have roll call?
Bortnander Lopez?
Aye.
Bortnander Clark?
Aye.
Bortnander Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
Aye.
Chair Scandora?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Our next item is a public hearing on administrative civil liability complaint related to Robinson Manufacturing. We are going to need time to set up for this hearing, so we are going to be taking a 10-minute break. We should be back within 10 minutes to begin that hearing.
Am I allowed to be off screen? Hello, am I allowed
yes,
to be
for off the screen? Yes, for the duration of the break, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and start up the hearing. Everybody's here. All right. Well, this is the time and place for the hearing in the matter of Administrative Civil Liability Complaint R8-2025-0017, which is issued to Robinson Manufacturing proposing a penalty of $50,000 on alleged violations of provisions of the Water Code for alleged failure to timely file annual reports for the years 2021 through 2022 and 2022 through 23 reporting years. This hearing was originally scheduled December 12, 2025, and was postponed to March 13, 2026 at the request of the respondent. The respondent made a second request to postpone the hearing, and the hearing was proposed to today by vote of the board. On April 22, 2026, the respondent made a third request to postpone the hearing. That request was denied by the presiding officer, myself, in accordance with the hearing procedure for this hearing. Accordingly, this matter is now proceeding to hearing before the board. I am John Scandura, Chair of the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board. Here with me in person are Vice Chair Gloria Alvarado, Board Members Leticia Clark and Al Lopez. Board Member Bill Rue is attending this meeting remotely. This hearing is also being conducted as a hybrid meeting with an option for the public to participate via Zoom. The board is being advised by supervising engineering geologist Alan Koch, Heraclio Pimentel, attorney for the Santa Ana Water Board, and Desta Masuda, attorney for the Santa Ana Water Board. The advisory team has not had any substantive conversations regarding the issues involved in this proceeding with the prosecution staff or with representatives of Robinson Manufacturing. Members of the prosecution team include Eric Lindberg, the executive officer, Brian Covalone, the assistant executive officer, Michelle Beckwith, senior environmental scientist, Katie Barber, environmental scientist, Nick Amini, supervising water resources control engineer, Carson Capps, attorney for the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement, and Catherine Haw, attorney with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. Neither the prosecution team nor attorneys are advising the Santa Ana Water Board in this matter. The prosecution team is a party to this proceeding. Do we have anyone from Robinson Manufacturing here? Seeing none. The official record of the testimony at this hearing will be created by our court reporter. This hearing is also being recorded. At the end of this hearing, the Santa Ana Water Board will close the hearing in this matter, and the board will deliberate on the evidence. The board may adjourn to closed session to consider the evidence received and deliberate on a decision. After considering evidence, the Santa Ana Water Board will make findings of fact and conclusions of law and determine whether to impose proposed civil liability, impose a higher amount or lower amount, or decline to impose any liability. All written evidence was required to be received by the applicable deadlines in the revised hearing procedure. The prosecution team submitted timely evidence and argument. The respondent did not submit evidence or argument. The board did not receive any written comments from non-parties or any evidentiary objections from the parties. Having received no objections, all materials that were received by the deadlines are now part of the record. If the parties use speaking notes or any visual aids illustrating previously submitted evidence with their presentation, those will be made part of the record. No other documentary evidence will be accepted into the record unless the board makes a specific ruling to allow it. If you intend to make a public comment on this item, please submit a speaker card. The hearing will be conducted in accordance with the revised hearing procedure and the order of proceedings. We will proceed as follows. Prosecution team, presentation of evidence first. Robinson Manufacturing may cross-examine the prosecution team's witnesses. Next is the presentation of Robinson Manufacturing's evidence. The prosecution team may then cross-examine Robinson Manufacturing's witnesses. Thereafter is any rebuttal by the prosecution team, followed by cross-examination or additional rebuttal testimony by Robinson Manufacturing, if any. Then we will receive public comments, and there's a three-minute time limit for each commenter, followed by questions from the board and advisory team, and then we will present the prosecution team's closing statement, followed by Robinson Manufacturing's closing statement. So any party wishing to present an opening statement should do so at the beginning of their evidentiary presentation. Any party wishing to conduct, redirect, or recross examination should request permission to do so at the appropriate time. So the prosecution team and Robinson Manufacturing each have 30 minutes for their presentation, cross-examination, and closing statements. The board members and the advisory team may ask questions of the parties and witnesses at any time. Time spent answering questions will not be deducted from the parties' 30-minute time allotments. So thank you for listening in on all that. And now is the time to administer the oath. So if you intend to provide testimony on this matter, please stand and raise your right hand or turn to the camera and raise your right hand if you're via Zoom. So, do you solemnly state under penalty of perjury that the evidence that you shall give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? All persons presenting testimony must state your name and whether you have taken the oath before testifying. So, I would like to call our prosecution team to make their presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Board Chair Scandura, and good morning. I'm Eric Lindberg, the prosecuting officer for this case, and I have taken the oath. We're joined in person by our Office of Enforcement Legal Counsel, Catherine Haw, our Stormwater Supervisor, Michelle Beckwith, our Surface Water Branch Manager, Nick Amini, our Assistant Executive Officer, Brian Covalone, and virtually by Office of Enforcement Staff, German Myers. We are here because when there's repeated non-compliance of basic requirements, escalation to enforcement is necessary. The civil liability complaint before you today carries significant fines, and collecting fines is never our goal. Fines exist as a deterrent when dischargers who have been regulated by our programs for decades continually delay and ignore important reporting requirements. It's critical to send a message to both the discharger here today and the regulated community that non-compliance cannot be the business standard in our region. Monetary enforcement is reserved for cases when repeated efforts by staff to encourage and facilitate compliance fail. Since its enrollment in the Stormwater Industrial General Permit, Robinson Manufacturing has continually failed to comply with the requirement to submit its annual report. As is our staff's regular practice, Robinson Manufacturing has received significant compliance assistance since it enrolled in our stormwater program and has submitted its annual reports after the due date for 21 of the last 30 years. Staff has invested a substantial amount of time in sending out 33 notices of noncompliance and reaching out directly to the discharger via email and phone calls. Attempts to engage and inspect Robinson were rebuffed, and yet the discharger still has not submitted these reports in a timely manner. Its failure to do so has significant and meaningful impacts to our regulatory program, where we rely on these reports to prioritize inspections and understand water quality impacts from thousands of industrial operators in our region. The evidence we present to you today is straightforward. The general permit requires permittees to submit an annual report by July 15th of each year. In the 2021, 2022, and 2022, 2023 reporting years, Robinson failed to meet its requirement, thereby violating the permit. They've not presented any evidence to the board to contradict this conclusion. Even so, the prosecution team has carefully put together a case which satisfies the burden of proof today. We will show how staff engaged in meaningful and repeated outreach over the years, trying to assist Robinson in meeting its obligations. We will show how these violations are especially important to avoid in disadvantaged communities and environmental justice communities. We will show that the proposed liability is reasonable and supported by the facts. My team will now present the evidence, and without further ado, here's Michelle Beckwith.
Good morning, Board Chair Scandura and members of the board. My name is Michelle Beckwith, and I am the supervisor of the General Stormwater Unit for the Santa Ana Water Board, and I have taken the oath. Today, I'll be presenting the proposed administrative civil liability complaint for Robinson Manufacturing under complaint number R8-2025-0017. This enforcement action addresses two alleged violations of the Industrial General Permit and your reporting requirements. Slide. Before I begin, I would like to briefly outline today's presentation. First, I will explain why this enforcement action is necessary, including the importance of annual reporting under the Industrial General Permit, provide background on Robinson Manufacturing and its operations, summarize the facility's enforcement history, including outreach efforts and continued noncompliance. Then I will walk through the violations outlined in the complaint, the penalty calculations, and staff recommendations. Slide. Under the Industrial General Permit, submittal of an annual report is required by July 15th annually. Robinson Manufacturing failed to submit two reports, the 21-22 report, which was submitted 441 days late, and the 22-23 report, which remains unsubmitted today, which is 1,014 days overdue. Note that for the 22-23 annual report, this slide specifically reflects 971 days overdue, which was originally prepared for the March 13th board hearing, which was postponed to today. Although both reports are overdue by more than 365 days, the prosecution team has capped each violation at 365 days for enforcement purposes, and I'll explain that methodology in more detail in the later presentation. These reports are essential in assessing compliance and understanding pollutant risks and their ability, and their absence limits the board's ability to ensure proper enforcement. Slide. The industrial general permit regulates stormwater discharges and authorized non-stormwater discharges from industrial facilities throughout California. The goal of the permit is to improve water quality in the state by addressing pollutants discharged through industrial activities. Permit coverage under the general permit is required for facilities with industrial classification code or SIC codes listed in Attachment A of the permit. Facilities must self-report their SIC code or codes using OSHA's SIC manual to accurately describe their industrial activity. Some examples of industrial facilities listed in Attachment A are manufacturing facilities, transportation facilities, and recycling facilities. The goal is to improve water quality in the state by addressing the pollutants to stormwater discharges associated with industrial activities. These pollutants are carried to rivers, streams, lakes, and the ocean through stormwater and non-stormwater runoff and can threaten and adversely affect human health and the environment. Slide. To comply with the general permit, facilities must develop a site-specific stormwater pollution prevention plan, or SWIP, and implement best management practices, or BMPs, to reduce or prevent pollutant discharges. Best management practices can range from basic housekeeping measures like sweeping to advanced treatment systems depending on the facility's pollutant profile. Facilities are also required to conduct stormwater sampling and submit an annual report by July 15th each year. This report summarizes sampling results, BMP effectiveness, and overall compliance status. Failure to submit the annual report is a violation of both the permit and Water Code Section 13383, which authorizes enforcement actions like the one presented today. Slide. The annual report is a key compliance tool. It provides a yearly snapshot of the facility's stormwater program and confirms whether required sampling, BMP implementation, and visual observations have been completed. This allows the Water Board to verify that the facility is meeting its permit obligations through accountability and transparency. Slide. The annual report also helps identify potential compliance issues and pollutant trends across the region. It supports targeted inspections, enforcement prioritization, and a broader water quality protection efforts. Without it, the board loses visibility into the facility's stormwater management practices, which undermines the effectiveness of the regulatory program. Slide. Now let's look at where Robinson Manufacturing is located. Robinson Manufacturing operates a metal fabrication facility at 1136 Richfield Road in the city of Placentia. The facility is situated in an industrial area, which is shown on the City of Placentia's land use map, highlighted in bright pink. This industrial setting reinforces the need for stormwater permit coverage because activities conducted at the site have a potential to discharge pollutants into nearby receiving waters. The facility self-reported that the Santa Ana River is its receiving water when enrolling under the industrial general permit. This is a critical compliance requirement because accurate reporting of receiving water ensures regulators can assess potential pollutants pathways and protect water quality. Under the general permit, this responsibility lies with the discharger. Slide. Robinson Manufacturing has been enrolled under the industrial general permit since 1995 and operates a metal fabrication facility. According to the facility website, however, Robinson Manufacturing was established in 1968 and conducts a range of industrial operations, including laser cutting, CNC machining, forming, welding, stamping, and foundry work. Note that this website is identified in Prosecution Team Exhibit Number 21. As displayed in Prosecution Exhibits Number 2 and 3, the facility self-identified and reported their SIC codes as 3499, 3441, 3449. These SIC codes are listed in Attachment A of the general permit and require permit coverage. Accurate self-reporting of SIC codes is critical because it determines whether a facility is subject to the industrial general permit and what compliance obligations apply. Determination of the applicable SIC code is the responsibility of the discharger. Robinson Manufacturing remains active and continues to conduct operations that generate industrial pollutants, reinforcing the importance of timely reporting and compliance with stormwater regulations. Slide. The Stormwater Enforcement Act of 1998, found in Water Code Section 13389.25 and the following sections, is this statutory authority we rely on for outreach and enforcement. This law requires the regional boards to identify facilities who have not obtained permit coverage or fail to comply with reporting requirements. For violations covered under this act, the board must issue two notices of noncompliance, giving the discharger 60 days to correct the violation. If a violation is not corrected, the board is required to issue a complaint for mandatory minimum penalty. This process ensures the facilities are given a fair opportunity to comply before penalties are imposed. Slide. Another key authority that applies to this enforcement action is the Water Code Section 13385. Section 13385 provides a statutory authority to the Regional Board to impose administrative civil liabilities, or ACLs, for violations of NPDES permits, including the Industrial General Permit. In this case, the ACL is based on Robinson Manufacturing's failure to timely submit annual reports, which are required by the General Permit and Water Code Section 13383. Under Section 13385(c)(1), the Water Court authorizes penalties of up to $10,000 per day for each violation occurrence. This authority applies directly to Robinson Manufacturing's failure to submit annual reports under the General Permit. Additionally, Section 13385 requires the regional boards to consider specific statutory factors when determining the amount of the administrative civil liability. The proposed liability amount is calculated in accordance with the State Water Resource Control Board enforcement policy, which I'll discuss later in the presentation. Section 13385 ensures that violations carry meaningful consequences to protect water quality and maintain compliance across the regulated community. It is the legal foundation for the penalty calculation presented. Slide. This slide depicts the timeline of enforcement actions for Robinson Manufacturing, specifically for late annual reporting under the Industrial General Permit. The timeline spans from 1995, when the facility first obtained permit coverage, through 2025, which is the most recent reporting period. The blue line represents the timeline. The squares indicate notices of violations. Circles represent notices of noncompliance. Stars identify violations alleged in this particular enforcement action. Yellow markers show the first notice was sent to the discharger, and red indicates second notices. Over the past 30 years, staff have issued 33 notices of noncompliance and multiple notices of violation for failing to submit annual reports on time. Despite repeated outreach and enforcement, the facility has continued to disregard this reporting requirement. Under principal progressive enforcement, the regional board escalates enforcement when prior actions fail to achieve compliance. Because of Robinson Manufacturing's chronic pattern of late reporting, we advanced issuing the notice of issuing the administrative civil liability complaint to address the two consecutive reporting violations. Slide. Now let's review the timeline identified in this complaint. This slide shows the blue timeline for Robinson Manufacturing's first alleged violation, which is for the late reporting, the late submittal of the annual report for 21-22 reporting period. The blue circles indicate courtesy emails, the blue triangles represent courtesy phone calls, the yellow star marks the annual report deadline, the orange pentagon shows when the notice of noncompliance was issued, the red diamonds represent the notice of noncompliance deadlines. The annual report was due July 15th of 2022. Prior to the deadline, the State Water Board sent courtesy reminder emails on June 16 and July 11 of 2022. After the deadline passed, Santa Ana Water Board issued the first notice of noncompliance on August 2nd with the deadline of August 31st, followed by a second notice on September 1st with a final deadline of September 30, 2022. These notices were sent via certified mail and confirmed received. On September 22nd, Santa Ana Water Board staff made a courtesy phone call to the facility, spoke with Robinson Manufacturing staff, and attempted to reach the legally responsible person. Staff informed facility personnel about the two notices of noncompliance and the final deadline. Board staff contact was provided, but no return phone call was received. On September 26th, board staff made another courtesy call, followed up with an email, including copies of the notice, and offered assistance. Again, no response was received. Ultimately, the annual report was submitted 441 days late on September 29th, 2023. Slide. This slide shows a blue line timeline for Robinson Manufacturing's second alleged violation, which is for the non-submittal of the 22-23 annual report. Similar to the previous slide, the blue circles indicate courtesy emails, blue triangles represent courtesy phone calls, the yellow star represents the annual report deadline, the orange pentagram shows that when notice of noncompliance was issued, and the red diamonds represent the notice of noncompliance deadlines. The annual report was due on July 15th, 2023, and remains unsubmitted as of today, 1,014 days late. State Water Board staff sent courtesy reminder emails on June 15th, 2023. After that deadline passed, Santa Ana Water Board issued a notice of noncompliance on August 1st with a deadline of August 30th. And the second notice was issued on August 31st with a final deadline of September 29th. On September 25th, Water Board staff sent another courtesy email reminding the facility of the deadline and warning of potential penalties and again offered assistance. No response was received. Santa Ana Water Board staff followed up with a phone calls on September 27th, 28th, and 29th. On the 27th, staff spoke with Robinson Manufacturing staff, who stated that they would forward the message to Mr. Acosta, who is the legally responsible person listed in SMARTS, which is the Stormwater Multiple Application Reporting System, which is our online database used to manage the stormwater permitting program. On the 25th, the same employee stated that Mr. Acosta had left early and would return the next day. Staff reiterated the urgency and confirmed the email address was correct. On the 29th, the employee stated that Mr. Acosta had submitted the annual report. However, when board staff checked SMARTS, however, only the 21-22 report had been submitted, not the 22-23 report. Staff again stressed the importance of meeting that final deadline, and the employee said that they would relay the message. Despite extensive outreach, Robinson Manufacturing failed to submit the required reports. Staff attempted multiple inspections, first which was denied despite the general permit authorizing access during business hours. And when access was later granted on a different inspection day, board staff confirmed that the facility lacked required reporting documents. Slide. This slide summarizes the alleged violations that form the basis of the proposed administrative civil liability complaint. Violation one pertains to Robinson Manufacturing's failure to submit the 21-22 annual report by the required deadline of July 15th of 2022, as outlined in Section 16A of the Industrial General Permit. Violation two pertains to the facility's failure to submit the 22-23 annual report by the deadline of July 15th of 2023. Under Water Code Section 1335(c)(1), each violation is subject to administrative civil liability for up to $10,000 per day. After consideration of the factors, as described in the enforcement policy, Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team is proposing an administrative civil liability amount of $50,000. I'll explain how we determine that $50,000 in the next slides. Slide. The Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team calculates Robinson Manufacturing's proposed penalty using the State Water Board's enforcement policy, which includes a 10-step process for determining administrative civil liability. These next two slides show that the prosecution team went through that full process. However, the individual calculations and factors did not ultimately determine the proposed final liability. Therefore, I will not be going into detail on every factor, but I can explain in more detail if needed. This slide summarizes steps 3 through 5, which establishes the base liability. For violation one, the 21-22 annual report, the initial liability is $161,000. And after applying adjustment factors for culpability, history, cleanup, and cooperation, the base liability increases to $272,090. For violation two, the 21-22 annual report, the initial liability is $253,000. With the same adjustment factors, the base liability increases to $495,880. Combined, the total base liability for both violations is $767,970. To maintain consistency with the enforcement policy, each violation is capped at 365 days because an annual report corresponds with a single reporting period. And although each report was more than a year late, the enforcement policy allows multiple day reduction method when a violation does not result in daily environmental harm. Under that method, the counted violation days were reduced to 46 days for each violation to keep the penalties proportionate. Slide. This slide summarizes steps 6 through 10 of the enforcement policy, which refine the penalty beyond the base liability. Step 6 calculates the economic benefit for noncompliance. Using the EPA BEN model, staff determined that Robinson Manufacturing avoided approximately $7,242 in costs relating to sampling, record keeping, and preparing their annual reports. Step 7 allows adjustments as justice may require. The prosecution team considers proportionality when similar cases under the Stormwater Enforcement Act, along with the facility's location in a disadvantaged community with the high pollution burden. Based on these factors, the staff issued enforcement discretion to reduce the penalty below the calculated base liability. Step 8 evaluates the discharger's ability to pay. Public business records show that Robinson Manufacturing reported $7.1 million in sales in 2023, confirming the ability to pay the proposed penalty without impacting operations. Step 9 establishes statutory limits, the maximum liability of $7.3 million, while the minimum, which is 10% above economic benefit, is $7,966. Finally, with step 10 establishes the proposed penalty. After considering economic benefit, proportionality, environmental justice, ability to pay, staff recommends reducing the combined base liability from $767,970 to $50,000. This amount reflects appropriate enforcement discretion while remaining consistent with similar actions under the Stormwater Enforcement Act. Slide. The prosecution team recommends that the Sonoma Water Board adopt the proposed administrative civil liability complaint number R8-2025-0017 as drafted by the prosecution team and impose administrative civil liability amount of $50,000 on Robinson Manufacturing. Slide. Thank you for your time and attention. Does the board have any questions?
Before we get into that, Jessica, how much time is remaining for the prosecution team?
8 minutes and 3 seconds.
Okay. All right, beginning with the advisory board first, do you have any questions? Or advisory group first.
Not at this time, Chair.
Okay. Board members, any questions? Remotely, board member Rue, do you have any questions?
No, I do not.
Okay. And then I just have a couple questions. So this facility has been in operation since 1968, and they first filed their industrial general permit back in 1995. When did the regulations for the industrial general permit come into play or take effect?
Michelle Beckwith, for the court reporter. The statewide stormwater permit came into effect in 1992.
Okay, so they filed just after. So these regulations haven't been in place the entire time that
Correct.
This facility's been in place. And then the second question, and this is all for the record, is what does it take to actually submit an annual report? Do they have to hire a consultant who then does a comprehensive audit and sampling and photographing and then preparing a report and submitting it to us, or is there some other way that they do this?
So in 2015, the most recent iteration of the industrial general permit moved annual report development from a paper document to online via SMARTS, the online database that we use for compliance. So it greatly streamlined the ability for dischargers to more timely submit their information and for staff to review the information. So the development of an annual report is a predefined form that's in SMARTS. So they're just literally entering yes, no's to certain questions. If they collect samples, they're entering their chemistry data. If they have any further evidence, whether it's explaining certain conditions, they can upload a letter, certified, done. It can take as little as 10 minutes. It might take longer if someone has a larger facility, but it has been greatly streamlined for accessibility via SMARTS.
And go ahead.
Good morning, board. My name is Catherine Ha. I'm an attorney with the State Water Board, and I'm representing the prosecution team today. I just wanted to add and clarify that for Robinson Manufacturing, Inc., there is no requirement to utilize a professional in developing its annual report. So any person that has authority within the system to submit it on behalf of the company would be able to do so, and no specific professional training or license is required to submit the annual report.
Okay. And seeing no other questions?
Actually, yeah, we have one question.
Sure.
One question, thank you. I believe that the complaint noted that we were electing not to seek staff costs. So my question is, can you explain why the prosecution team elected not to seek staff costs in determining the final liability amount here?
As explained by Ms. Beckwith, the decision to reduce the overall liability is primarily driven by the application of the factor of other factors as justice may require, and that analysis is articulated within Attachment A. But to summarize it for the purpose of this conversation, the decision to not enhance the liability was made in order to assess what we believed was a reasonable penalty in light of the historic utilization by the Stormwater Program of the Stormwater Enforcement Act to enforce on these kinds of violations. The Stormwater Enforcement Act provides for a maximum liability of $1,000 plus staff costs for each annual report. The liability under Water Code Section 13385 is far more significant at $10,000 for each day a report is late or missing. These two violations that are alleged in the complaint are subject to a mandatory minimum penalty under the Stormwater Enforcement Act, but because of the potential impacts to an environmental justice community where this facility is located and the chronic history of noncompliance, we thought it was appropriate to seek a liability greater than what would have been authorized under the Stormwater Enforcement Act, but not as great as what the statutory maximum would have been under Water Code Section 13385. So consistent with that decision to try to keep the penalty to a number that we felt was appropriate, a decision was made not to add staff costs. It is accurate to say that the State Water Board's enforcement policy does encourage the addition of staff costs, and the board obviously has the discretion to add those costs today. We do have evidence in the record which would support the ability of the board to add those staff costs. They are prosecution team exhibits 21 through 26. Those are declarations from our staff, which provide a basis for including the staff costs if the board were to choose to do so.
Perfect. Thank you for your explanation.
And then Heraclio?
That's all, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. So now is the opportunity for Robinson Manufacturing to present to make their presentation. And once again, is anyone here or online for Robinson Manufacturing? So not hearing any. And of course, this is the opportunity for the prosecution team to present a rebuttal. And do you wish to present a rebuttal?
No.
Obviously not. And certainly Robinson Manufacturing is not here to present a rebuttal to the rebuttal. So are there any persons that have that would like to make comments, public comments?
No, there are no public comments.
Okay. And then board members, do you have any questions? Seeing none. And do members of the advisory team have any questions?
None, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. And does the prosecution team wish to make a closing statement?
Yes. Good morning again, Catherine Haw for the prosecution team. It is a pleasure to be in your region this morning. Thank you, Board Chair Scandura and members of the board for your time. This case is straightforward, but it does provide the board with an opportunity to send an important message both to Robinson Manufacturing and to the regulated community. In this region, you must submit your reports to the water boards. Failure to submit these kinds of reports is not a superficial paperwork violation. It has real impacts on the region's regulatory programs. As you heard from staff, these reports are critical to understanding the effectiveness of best management practices at a facility, obtaining water quality data, and prioritizing inspections. The facts of this particular matter are simple. Robinson Manufacturing was required to submit an annual report to comply with the Industrial General Permit and Water Code Section 13383. Robinson Manufacturing failed to submit its annual reports for both the 21-22 reporting year and 2022 and 2023 reporting year. You heard from staff that there was extensive outreach involved in assisting the discharger with understanding and complying with this regulatory requirement, including the issuance of Stormwater Enforcement Act notices of noncompliance for the two reporting years at issue and for over 15 years prior to the initiation of this enforcement action. Despite these efforts, Robinson Manufacturing offered no evidence today which merits a change in the proposed liability. Robinson could not demonstrate that its reports were submitted or the deadline did not apply to it. It could not, in good faith, explain that it did not know about the requirement or that its continued noncompliance did not generate an economic advantage. In closing, the prosecution team urges the board to adopt the proposed liability as drafted in the prosecution team's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. The proposed liability is reasonable and fair. It considers the impacts to the regulatory program, the chronic compliance issues at this facility, and impacts to an environmental justice community. In doing so, send a clear message to Robinson Manufacturing, Inc. and to the regulated community throughout your region. Comply with your reporting requirements. Work diligently with staff when we reach out, and return to compliance before the principle of progressive enforcement dictates a penalty action. Thank you again for your time this morning.
Okay, and now is the opportunity for Robinson Manufacturing to make a closing statement. And once again, is there anybody who is either here in person or online from Robinson Manufacturing that wishes to make a closing statement? Okay, hearing none, this public hearing is now closed. So at this point, I'd like to ask my fellow board members if they'd like to continue this discussion here in open session or if there's a wish to go into closed session.
I'm very comfortable doing it here in open session.
Okay, and I'm seeing lots of nods and I'm in support of that as well. So any discussion, board members?
I would like to address the assessment of staff time, if possible. I think it's really important to set a precedent that staff time is valuable. You know, we're good stewards of public funding, and I believe, as the closing statement iterated, that we have to send a strong message to the community that not only are these reporting requirements important, but I believe staff exuded a lot of grace in terms of communicating with Robinson Manufacturing, and they do the same amount of work and due diligence with everyone that they communicate with, but not taking into account the staff time that was exuded to, I mean, everything that we've seen over, you know, a lot of paperwork and several hearings, that it's I think it shows, it sends a message of what we value, and not assessing that is actually a message in the wrong direction, that we don't value staff time. So I don't know what we need to do in terms of incorporating that into the overall assessment, but I do believe that that should be discussed with this board, and I think it just sends a strong message about what we value.
I'll ask the advisory team, do we have a current total of staff costs?
Yes, we do. The total that was included in the complaint is $7,784 in staff costs.
Okay. Any other comments, or Board Member Lopez?
Yeah. Of all the period, you know, the total period that he has not submitted any reports, is this the first time that this violation has been brought to the board for some penalty or some?
That's correct. So this is the first in formal enforcement action against this particular discharger. We alluded to them receiving dozens of Stormwater Enforcement Act enforcement notices in years prior. The Stormwater Enforcement Act essentially provides dischargers 60 days after those notices to submit a report before a penalty is triggered. So they have narrowly avoided being subject to a mandatory minimum penalty prior to today. But the continued chronic noncompliance is the reason why we are before you at this point.
Okay. Any others? Board Member Rue, online?
Yes, if staff recommendation is $50,000, then we have about $7,000 in staff cost. Maybe we could add that on and make the penalty $57,000
or $58,000. Okay. All righty. And as for me, as mentioned before, this is a fairly straightforward case. I think what kind of stands out is a lot of patterns that we're seeing. Certainly, this facility enrolled in the program not long after the regulations were put in place, but then over a 30-year period, they didn't submit their required annual reports for 24 of those years. And then when they did, it seemed to be kind of in fits and spurts. About 15 years ago, I think they submitted reports for 2 or 3 years in a row, and then about 4 or 5 years ago, they submitted reports for about 4 years in a row, and then this last report, they submitted was, I think, 472 days late, something like that. In these last two reports that are the subject of this hearing, the staff has made extensive efforts to call the facility, email the facility, remind them of the requirement. And then I think the other thing that's very important is that, as you could see in the tenor of my questions, this is not something that's designed to be an expensive, major imposition, regulatory imposition on this facility. Everything is on a database. All you have to do is you get a user ID and a password, you go onto the database, you enter your information. You don't have to be an expert or a computer whiz in this field to do that. And this facility has failed to do that in the last three of the last 4 years. And then on top of that, this facility has known since September of our intent to pursue enforcement action. We gave them options in a letter back in September to either show up at a hearing in December or waive the hearing right and settle with us. They didn't do anything until I think it was 2 or 3 days before the December hearing when they asked for a postponement. We gave them a postponement for 3 months. And then a day or two before the March meeting, they requested another postponement. We gave them another 7 weeks to do this. And then what we heard 2 days ago was that the owner of the facility could not make the hearing because he had a medical procedure. But we saw no documents whatsoever from any physicians or experts saying that his procedure couldn't be rescheduled or that he, for whatever reason, couldn't be here. It just seems to me that there's just this unwillingness by this facility to take these regulations seriously. Well, I've got news for him, this facility and for all the other facilities out there. We do take these regulations seriously, and unfortunately, we have to proceed with this action. And so I would certainly support a penalty of $50,000 plus $7,784 for our staff costs. And those staff costs went up because we had to renotice this hearing and prepare for the second postponed hearing. So with that, advisory team, any other further questions or comments or advice for us?
If the board is inclined to make a determination in open session and adopt the order today, I would advise making two motions, one for a liability and imposition of the amount, and then the second on the order. And if the board does decide to move forward with an order, we would like to propose some advisory team changes for adoption prior to the order. And so with that, we can, if there's any other further questions, I can clarify.
Okay. And then if we do adopt the changes that you recommended, do we need to come back to another meeting to formally adopt, or can we adopt the order today?
No, if the board is in accord with the proposed changes that we would read into the record, then we can adopt the order today as proposed, or with any further changes that the board may request.
Okay.
I would go along with that. I think that's reasonable.
Okay. And any other questions from the board members? And do we have a motion for adoption of this order
May I interject? So if you'd like, I can present the motion. No. It appears that the motion that should be made is the imposition of liability for the alleged violations for the amount proposed plus staff costs.
Okay.
And so if that's the motion that wants to be made, a board member can make that motion.
Okay. And do we have a motion?
I will make a motion to that effect.
I'll second.
Okay.
And just for clarification, the motion is for the imposition or the finding of liability for the two alleged for the two violations alleged in the complaint in the amount of a total civil liability for $57,784.
Okay. Yes, correct.
Okay. And are we ready for a roll call vote?
Bortnander Lopez.
Aye.
Bortnander Clark.
Aye.
Bortnander Rue.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
Aye.
Chair Scandura.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
And the advisory team, any further motions or changes?
If the board would like to move forward with adopting the order today, we would like to read some changes into the record for consideration of the changes to the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law as a presentation for the order.
Okay. And so we would need to make another motion to adopt those changes, correct?
Right. After we, again, if the board is inclined to adopt the order, we can read those changes now. And then if, unless there's any other changes, the board can make a motion for adoption of the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law with the changes presented by the advisory team.
Okay. And I don't see any requests for further changes from the board members. So if you could read the proposed changes into the record, and then we'll make the motion.
All right. Changes to the caption, non-substantive changes would be proposed. Changes to paragraph 2, the first sentence would be struck. This paragraph would read, the discharger has been enrolled in the industrial general permit or its predecessor order since August 30, 1995, when it originally submitted its notice of intent, NOI, WDID 830I0I11852. The discharger is subject to the term, and the addition of the following sentence, the discharger is subject to the terms of the permit because it conducts an industrial activity for it, for which it has obtained regulatory coverage under the permit. There would be an addition of paragraphs 6, 7, and 8. Paragraph 6 would read, the hearing on the complaint was originally scheduled for December 12, 2025 and was postponed to March 13, 2026 at the discharger's request. On the morning of the March 13th hearing, the discharger made a second request to postpone the hearing, and the hearing was postponed to April 24th, 2026. New paragraph 7 would read, on April 22nd, 2026, the discharger made a third request to postpone the hearing, which was denied by the presiding officer on April 23rd, 2026, in accordance with the revised hearing procedure for this hearing. New paragraph 8 would add, a hearing took place on April 24th, 2026, in accordance with the hearing notice and procedures served on the discharger and applicable laws and regulations, including California Code of Regulations, Title 23, Section 648-648.8. Paragraph 14 would be changed, would be corrected to read violations 1 and 2. Struck out would be 3, 6. Paragraph 16 would include the word proposed amount of $50,000 and add plus staff cost of $7,784 for a total liability amount of $57,784. In the section making the order, paragraph 1 would read, Robinson Manufacturing Inc. shall be assessed an administrative civil liability in the amount of $50,000 plus in the amount of $57,784. And then there would be a correction made to the signature page for the current date. Attachment A at the end would be changed to specific factors considered for administrative civil liability order number R8-2025-0017. Additionally, we would have some changes for the attachment A. One second. Apologies, technical difficulties. Okay, attachment A, which would be included as part of the order, would change the title from Administrative Civil Liability Complaint to Administrative Civil Liability Order. The first paragraph would change the word alleged to found. The date in the caption would be changed, as well as references to complaint would be changed to order. Corrections to grammatical corrections to the culpability section would be added. Step 7 would include the following paragraphs. The 2024 enforcement policy provides that the water boards may exercise their discretion to include some of the costs of the investigation, enforcement, and civil liability, including some staff costs. Some staff investigations and enforcement costs is valid from an economic standpoint, as it requires those who commit water quality violations to pay a greater percentage of the full cost of their violations. Water boards are strongly encouraged to recover staff costs that reflect the effort to investigate and issue an enforcement action. Cites to 2024 enforcement policy at page 28. The Santa Ana Water Board finds that it is appropriate and consistent with the enforcement policy to increase the total base liability amount by $7,784 in consideration of the cost of investigation and enforcement necessitated by the discharger's lack of cooperation with staff's investigation. Therefore, the proposed total base liability amount is increased by $7,784 for a total base liability amount of $57,784. And then step 10, which be titled final liability amount. Final liability amount final liability amount $57,784. The final liability amount consists of the proposed total base liability amount of $50,000 plus staff's investigation and enforcement cost of $7,784. Based on the foregoing analysis and consistent with the enforcement policy, the final administrative civil liability is $57,784. And then minor corrections to the first paragraph in that section, which would now read, based on the foregoing analysis and consistent with the environmental enforcement policy, the final liability amount for violations 1 and 2 is $57,784. And those are the changes that we would propose.
Okay. And do we have a motion to issue the order with the changes proposed by the
advisory committee? I will make that motion.
Okay.
I'll second it.
I'd second that motion.
Seconded by the vice chair. Okay. Jessica, can we have a roll call vote?
Lord Nender Lopez?
Aye.
Lord Nender Clark?
Aye.
Lord Nender Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
Aye.
Chair Scandora?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. Item number 9, our enforcement hearing is now concluded. Do we need a break to regroup or?
Maybe just a short 5-minute break so that we can change the chairs around.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, we are back from break. Our next item is item number 10, is an information item. Claudia Tenorio will present an overview of the state wetland definition and procedures for discharges of dredged or fill material to waters of the state. And certainly our state board liaison sort of set a little bit of the stage for this presentation and her discussion. Claudia.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Chair Scandura and members of the board. I'm Claudia Tenorio. I'm a senior environmental scientist, and I oversee our regional planning program section. This section is responsible for overseeing projects that have discharges of dredge or fill material. And today, I'll be presenting an informational item on the statewide procedures for discharges of dredge or fill, which I'll just refer to as the procedures for the remainder of the presentation. Next slide. Okay, so this is an outline of what I'm going to be covering today. I'll first start with defining certain terms and concepts related to dredge and fill. I'll also provide an overview of the procedures as well as the application process, project types and impacts, and then a discussion on compensatory mitigation. Next slide. So when we're talking about the procedures, what do we mean by dredge and fill material? So first define, dredge material is material that is excavated or dredged from the bottom of waterways. This can be sediment or debris. And typically dredging is associated with maintenance activities to maintain navigational depths of navigational channels. And fill material is material that is used to change the bottom elevation or replace an aquatic feature with land. And fill material can include dirt, sand, rock, or aggregate. Next slide. So I will be providing an overview of waters of the United States and waters of the state because it was mentioned today that does play a role and impact the permitting approaches when we're talking about regulating these types of discharges. So waters of the United States, it's a threshold term in the Clean Water Act that establishes the geographical scope of federal jurisdiction. The Clean Water Act itself does not define waters of the United States, but rather the U.S. EPA and the Department of the Army are responsible for defining waters of the United States. The most recent change happened in 2023, but like what we heard at the report today, there is a proposal to further change the definition of waters of the United States. In general, waters of the United States can be put in different types of categories. First, we have A1 waters, which are traditional navigable waters, territorial seas, and interstate waters. We have A2 waters, which are impoundments of waters of the state. And an example of an impoundment could be, you know, the Santa Ana River Prado Dam in Riverside County. We also have relatively permanent tributaries, and these are tributaries that have a continuous standing water or ponding water throughout the entire year or during certain times of the year. And then we also have adjacent wetlands, and these are wetlands that physically abut or touch another relatively permanent water. Waters of the United States can also include other waters, but in the dredge and fill program, these are typically the waters that we're dealing with when we're talking about discharges of dredge and fill. And also for people that are listening online, you know, you feel free to refer to the Federal Register to make sure that you have a complete description, legal definition of waters of the United States. Next slide. Okay, so we also have waters of the state, which is defined by water code. The water code defines waters of the state very broadly to include any surface water or groundwater, including saline waters within the boundaries of the state. And the water code does not include any physical descriptors of what is a waters of the state. So it's a very broad definition. Waters of the state can include some, but not all, wetlands, as well as other features, including the ocean, lakes, and rivers. And waters of the state can also include dry or perennial waters. And here in our region, in the arid west, most of waters of the state are dry most of the year and only have surface waters in response to precipitation. Next slide. So water quality certifications. Under the Clean Water Act, any person that is applying for a federal license or permit that may result in a discharge, it could be a discharge of dredge or fill, must obtain a water quality certification certifying that that discharge and that activity will comply with applicable water quality standards. So a federal agency may not issue that license or permit until the state or whoever has the certifying authority to issue certifications has issued a certification or waiver of certification. And in California, that's the State Water Board and the regional boards that issue those water quality certifications under the Clean Water Act. Next slide. We also have waste discharge requirements. In the state of California, discharges of dredge or fill material have historically been treated as discharges of waste by the water boards. So if a project involves placing or discharging dredge or fill material into a waters of the state that does not fall under federal jurisdiction, that activity and that discharge may be regulated through WDRs, which is similar to the items that you approved earlier this morning. Next slide. All right, so now I'll jump into the actual procedures. In 2019, the State Water Board adopted the dredge and fill procedures, which includes four major elements. The procedures established a wetland definition, a statewide definition to be used by the water boards, as well as established a jurisdictional framework for determining if a wetlands is a waters of the state, as well as a wetland delineation framework. And for the procedures, what I just mentioned, the wetland definition and framework for delineation, that's for wetland-only waters. And then for all other waters, the procedures also established an application submittal process for and also a review and approval process, and as well as some exclusions for certain activities. Next slide. So I'll briefly touch on the wetland definition. As I mentioned, the procedures established a statewide wetland definition to be used by the water boards. Prior to that, the water boards relied on the federal definition of wetlands. But with the procedures, we have a wetland definition. So the procedures defined a wetland as an area that under normal circumstances, the area has continuous or recurrent saturation of the upper substrate, and that duration of the saturation is sufficient to cause anaerobic conditions, and as well, the area's vegetation is dominated by hydrophytes or lax vegetations. So under the procedures, this is what we would call like a three-parameter wetland, which includes hydrology, soils, and vegetation. Next slide. So application requirements under the procedures. Like I mentioned, the procedures also establish a process and framework for reviewing dredge and fill projects. So items required for a complete application under the dredge and fill procedures include delineation reports for both waters of the U.S. and waters of the state, impact maps that show the project location as well as what are the impacts to waters, a description of the waters that are proposed to be impacted, an alternatives analysis, which may be required on a case-by-case basis, and I'll provide a little bit more information on the next slide as to when an alternatives analysis is required, compensatory mitigation for unavoidable impacts, documentation with compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, as well as an application fee. And then I will mention that when our office receives an application, we have 30 days to review the application and determine if the submittal is complete or make an incompleteness determination and request additional information to be submitted for our review. Next slide. So alternatives analysis. Like I mentioned, that's in the previous slide, alternatives analysis may be required on a case-by-case basis. And the requirement to prepare an alternatives analysis is dependent on the type of impact, the impact size, as well as the resources that are being impacted. Is this an area that is rare or threatened or an area of biological significance? Alternatives analysis are not required for projects to qualify under an existing general order for dredge and fill. So under the procedures, an alternatives analysis is the process of analyzing project alternatives, including the proposed project, to determine that the alternative is the least environmentally damaging practicable alternative. And under the procedures, practicable is a very important term because that means that the alternatives that are being analyzed are able and capable of being complete after taking into account cost, existing technology, and other logistical concerns while still being able to meet the project goals. Next slide. So types of projects that may require permitting under dredge and fill include, but are not limited to, these are just some of the projects that we see most often, residential and industrial developments, undergrounding of facilities, intake and outfall structures, piers and docks. We also have stream bank and habitat modification projects, beach nourishment or beach enhancement, erosion control, habitat restoration projects. We also see quite a bit of crossings for bridges, culverts, and utilities. Next slide. So impact types. So impacts related to dredge and fill can be categorized into permanent and temporary impacts. Permanent impacts are those that permanently change an aquatic resource to a non-aquatic resource. Permanent also impacts that change the bottom elevation of an aquatic resource. And permanent impacts can result in the physical loss of water resources or ecological degradation of those resources. And permanent impacts do require compensatory mitigation to offset those impacts. And temporary impacts are just that, temporary. They may cause a temporary loss in physical area or ecological degradation. However, the difference is that these impacts must be restored to pre-project conditions, either through natural processes or active restoration to restore that area to pre-project conditions. And if an area is not able to be restored, then that impact will be classified as permanent, requiring compensatory mitigation. Next slide. So, talking about compensatory mitigation, if a project does have unavoidable permanent impacts to waters of the U.S. or waters of the state, the procedures procedures allow mitigation to be performed using the following methods: restoration, enhancement, establishment, and in some cases, preservation. And that can be done through three ways. First, we have permittee responsible mitigation. This is where the permittee that's undertaking the project is responsible for undertaking the mitigation that includes the design, implementation, and monitoring of a mitigation site. We also have in-lieu fees or in-lieu fee programs, and this is a type of third-party mitigation where fees are collected, and then once enough fees have been collected, so we do advanced credit sales, and once enough fees have been collected, that money is then used to establish a mitigation site at a later time. So typically with in-lieu fee programs, impacts from projects are occurring, project and mitigation being established. And the biggest point for in-lieu fee programs is that the sponsors for the in-lieu fee programs have to be non-governmental or nonprofit organizations that are undertaking the program. And then lastly, mitigation banking. Mitigation banks are a physical area in the environment. It could be a wetland, a river, or another type of aquatic resource that is being restored or preserved for the sole purpose of providing compensatory mitigation for impacts. And mitigation is usually done in advance of impacts occurring for individual projects. And with mitigation bankings, this can be a for-profit private entity. Next slide. So compensatory mitigation types. I'll provide an overview because it could be pretty involved with the types of different mitigation. So I'll provide an overview on the different types of mitigation. So under the procedures, establishment involves modifying the environment to develop an aquatic resource in an area where that resource did not exist before. So establishment results in a net gain in So establishment results in a gain in aquatic resource area and function. Then we have restoration, which includes either the reestablishment or rehabilitation of aquatic resources, and this involves returning or repairing the natural or historic function of a degraded aquatic resource. And then enhancement is heightening, intensifying, or improving a specific aquatic resource function. And this does result in an increase in aquatic resource function, but does not result in a gain in area. And then lastly, we have preservation, which is the removal of a threat or preventing the decline of an aquatic resource. And with preservation, this does not result in the net gain in area or function. And then next slide. So this is my last slide before we go into questions. I did want to take some time to highlight some accomplishments and challenges in our Dredge or Fill program. In 2025, our office received 79 applications and notifications for projects proposing to discharge dredge or fill material. Our staff and this board issued 29 water quality certifications and WDRs. We also issued 19 notices of applicability. Most of those notices of applicability were done as a response to emergency projects from some of the recent storm events that we had last year. And challenges for the program are just a high volume of application. We also have short statutory timelines to review projects and provide comments on information related to impacts, and just increasing project complexity to ensure compliance with water quality standards. And then with that, can open it up to questions. I have a slide, but just it's for questions.
Okay. Board members, any questions? Board Member Lopez.
Yes. On slide 15, the compensatory mitigation, why is it restoration is second and not first? You would think that restoration would be a priority first, you know, or is there a reason for that?
Well, establishment, when we're talking about hierarchy, establishment, I mean, all of these are very important for resources, right. But establishment results in both a gain in area and function. Usually with restoration, we're taking an area that's degraded and we're improving it. It doesn't result in an increase in area. So when we're talking about, you know, restoring or offsetting some of those impacts, establishment has both. With restoration, typically it's one or the other.
It's just that I, you know, when I look at projects like that, and I look, geez, why don't they try to restore it first before they try to do something else, you know? But you say there's no real reason for it being second.
Are we talking about like temporary, like for impacts?
Yeah, that they would encourage restoration first.
Yeah, restoration does happen. We see, especially for in-lieu fee programs and mitigation banking, typically that does involve restoration. That's typically what we're seeing with our in-lieu fee programs and mitigation banks. It's restoration. But we're talking about a hierarchy establishment in the overall scheme, you know, has both, but restoration is done quite a bit with our banks and in-lieu fee programs. That's their main focus.
So, Board Member Lopez, if I could. When I was young, my grandfather gave me a piece of Plymouth rock. I thought, wow, that's really neat. Later on in life, I realized that if everybody does that, there's no more Plymouth rock, right? And we think about our waters of the state in the same way. A lot of projects chip away at our waters of the state. And where we can, we preserve, you know, certain bits. We enhance existing. I think that the point of establishment is that it's a net increase, and I think that's what Claudia was just saying. It's an opportunity for us to put a chip back on the rock. There's no doubt that restoration is important. We certainly prioritize restoration. When we have an opportunity to establish new waters, we take advantage of that.
Okay. Any other questions here? Vice Chair Alvarado.
Not to continue the conversation, but when you're looking at it, preservation for me will be like the most important one, right? Mm-hmm. But looking at the rankings, I just want to thank you for the presentation. I think it's very informative, and I think it highlights the work that we continue to do, all of us working together to highlight the importance of actually building new, preserving, and definitely restoring what has been damaged. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Board Member Rue, any questions or comments?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Okay, and then just a couple on my end. First of all, thank you for the presentation. It does tie into not only the State Board's presentation, but also a couple of our items that were on the consent calendar today. And so, and seeing the presentation, it looks like the identification of waters of the United States or waters of the state, that all occurs at the application stage.
Correct, we work with the Army Corps, and they're the ones that do the formal determination for what is the waters of the U.S. when we're talking about the permitting.
Yeah. Right, and then the application isn't deemed complete until the Water Board staff is satisfied that they've identified those water bodies.
Correct, okay. Yeah, that is one of the requirements. They're required to identify, you know, what is waters of the U.S. and what federal permits they're seeking, or if they're not seeking federal permits. That is part of the application review process.
Okay. And then if they do identify waters of the United States, does the Army Corps of Engineers always review that determination, or are there times they just say, sorry?
In my experience, yes, they do take the time to review it.
Okay.
Sometimes it could be more of an informal or formal process, but we typically do try to get that confirmation from the Army Corps that, you know, they have reviewed it to make those findings and make sure that, you know, in our WDRs.
Yeah. Now with the definition, well, it's kind of crazy because under the first Trump administration, the definition contracted, and then in the Biden administration, it went back almost to where it was before. Now it looks like US EPA and the Corps of Engineers are looking at contracting or narrowing that definition, which of course means more work on our part.
Yes. Yeah, I think since I started at the board, I think it's changed four times.
And then last of all, in your last slide, accomplishments and challenges, how many of those permits actually come to the board? Do all of them or just a portion of them?
Just a portion of them. The individual WDRs that are typically on the consent calendar, those come to the board. The executive officer does have authority to sign water quality certification, so you typically don't see those because they go to Eric, the executive officer. And notices of applicability, those are issued under general orders that have already been adopted, so those can also be issued by the executive officer. So typically you're just seeing those WDRs. Yeah.
That don't have those previous actions associated with them. Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Jessica, are there any speaker cards on this item?
No, there are no speaker cards.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Claudia.
Thank you.
Okay, our next item is the executive officer's report. And
thank you, Chair Scandura. It's always a pleasure to address the board. What can I say? I love my job. This is great. Vice Chair Diadamo always steals my thunder. She talks about all the best stuff. But I do have a couple things that I'd like to just tack on to the comments that she provided earlier regarding some statewide issues that affect our region. Specifically, her mention of the integrated report. The integrated report is the mechanism by which the listing and delisting of impaired water bodies under the Clean Water Act is made. Our region is on cycle to do that evaluation in the 2030 report. However, for the 2030 report, the data solicitation deadline is August of this year. So there's a significant delay between when we close the gates on the data that will be evaluated and the actual evaluation itself. So I scream this from the mountaintops as much as I can. It's really critical for those entities who collect water quality data, surface water data in particular, to submit that data and in particular submit it to the CEDIN system, which is the statewide system, to collect those data. It's always unfortunate when we have water quality challenges and the data are out of date simply because a lack of submission. So my plea goes out to the public, to our stakeholder partners in the watershed, please recognize the data solicitation deadline of August 2026 and take it seriously. My staff are ready. They're standing by to help with any data upload needs. It's very critical. The other thing that Vice Chair Diadamo mentioned was the wastewater needs assessment. One part of that needs is it's a statewide effort. It helps to bring resources to those agencies that have a need that's not being met, particularly if particular focus is given to communities that are either disadvantaged or there's an environmental justice component to that. Our staff are working with the staff at the State Water Resources Control Board, the Division of Water Quality, to identify communities and agencies in our region that could use resources, in particular related to the conversion of septic to sewer systems. As you know, our region is, while it does have some rural areas, it is a highly urbanized, highly developed watershed. The density of population in our region is incredibly high compared to the rest of the state. There are areas that used to be more rural that are certainly not now. And as the density increases of these septic systems, the threat to water quality increases. So failing systems are a problem. An increase in density of systems from one parcel to the next, particularly when those parcels are subdivided, is a problem. The addition of, for example, accessory dwelling units on a parcel can overload a system that was designed for a single-family home. And our staff face tremendous challenges in trying to address the needs to both encourage and facilitate development and to protect water quality. So where those communities are still on septic, I want to urge our partner agencies to do what they can to sewer those communities. We are working with the state board staff to find funding avenues and identify those needs so that we can hopefully marry those two things up and have our agencies expand sewer systems, serve communities that are, you know, currently on on-site waste treatment systems. And I think it would be an absolute win for water quality to see more of those areas sewered. I do think that staff have a presentation and information item. We may be bringing an agency in to help talk about it, but that information item would be to present some of the ins and outs of the septic challenges that I've just mentioned. So I hope to bring that in a future meeting. There are a couple of meetings that I just wanted to make a very quick mention of. On April 22nd, I attended the committee day at the Clean Water SoCal organization. Molten Gale Water District hosted us. They were very gracious in doing so. It's a fantastic facility. And I got to say, their data tools at Molten Gale are incredible. Maybe I can convince them to come down and talk to you. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I met some of the water leaders, not only in our region, but across Southern California at that meeting. We had a great discussion on priorities of our board, but also some of the statewide things. We know that maximum contaminant limits are coming for PFAS compounds, probably in the next 12 to 18 months, give or take. And that will pose a challenge, particularly for some of our, and when I say our, in this case, I mean Southern California, wastewater agencies, where the influent water to those plants is high in PFAS compounds. Naturally, the effluent is as well. And, you know, the science is racing to try to keep up. We don't have a good grip yet on the ecological impacts, but we certainly know that there are human impacts to being exposed to PFAS. So we're taking that very seriously, and I propose to continue having both myself and my staff engage with wastewater agencies in Southern California to determine a good regulatory path to dealing with PFAS in wastewater effluent. Another meeting, this one's coming up next week on April 30th, is the Lake Elsinore-San Jacinto Watershed Authority's 2026 Summit. The board might remember that we recently, last year, well, almost 12 months ago now, adopted the Lake Elsinore Canyon Lake Total Maximum Daily Load Basin Plan Amendment. That amendment is still making its way through the processes up in Sacramento. But that was a major accomplishment, and I hope to, they've asked me to come and speak at that summit. I'll share both the successes that we've seen in going through that process, particularly how the collaborative approach that we take, the task force approach that we take with our partners, and of course the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority, the Lake Elsinore-San Jacinto Watershed Authority, in bringing good things to our watershed. So I'll be speaking at that summit. I'm very much looking forward to it. I very much appreciate the invitation. And then lastly, if I could just take a second to thank Mr. Paul Cook, who's the general manager here at Irvine Ranch Water District. He and his staff have graciously hosted us here. It's a beautiful facility. It had been a while since I'd been here. Anyway, it's very impressive. So thank you to Mr. Cook and his staff for hosting us. And I'm happy to take any questions from the board members.
Any questions from the board members? Okay, now's the time for board member communications. Do we have board member communications? Board member Lopez?
Well, I'd like to share a personal achievement myself, another milestone that a couple of weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago, I had my 85th birthday.
So no way.
I can call myself a senior now, huh? But thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to continue to be on this board, and I hope that I could stay up with as much as possible on all the staff reports, and also want to thank staff, you know, for helping me in some occasions with my password, you know, to log on, that sometimes it's very difficult for me to come up with my style of password, but I appreciate it. Thank you very much, everyone.
Okay.
Happy birthday. And I can let you know that that's not a function of age. We have password issues throughout the organization.
I know it's not a board action, but yeah. But,
okay. Board Member Clark.
Well, happy belated, Board Member Lopez. I think we can all aspire to be as active and as sharp as you are at 85. That's amazing. I just wanted to give some kudos to staff. Just really appreciate how on point you guys are with everything, and particularly our executive officer. I see a local friend of mine, JB Law, who's a student at Cal State Fullerton, in the audience today, and that's I think a tribute to executive officer Eric, who has been so open to a lot of my recommendations and suggestions of trying to get our local residents and students involved and interested in the work that we do. And you've been so open to those ideas, and I think it's just a testament to trying to be better at our outreach efforts and better about our education efforts, which we've talked about a lot at this level. And so I just want to thank you for just continuing to be open to those suggestions, and good to see you, JB. All right, thank you.
Okay. Board Member Rue.
Just a moment. There we go. Congratulations, Director Lopez, on a milestone. We appreciate your input, and I struggle on a daily basis with all technology, not just passwords. So you're ahead of me. Thank you.
Okay. Vice Chair Alvarado.
Just want to extend my gratitude to staff for being so prepared and for sharing your knowledge and your guidance. And also, thanks again to the Irvine Ranch Water District for hosting us. Thank you.
Okay, and as for me, happy birthday, Al, and also to other board members and staff here who just recently celebrated a birthday or will be celebrating one very, very soon. I also wish to thank the Irvine Ranch Water District for providing these beautiful facilities today, and we look forward to having future meetings here. My thanks to the board members for being here, and especially during these enforcement hearings. These are not easy, a lot of evidence to go through, testimony we need to hear, and certainly very difficult decisions to make. I, too, will be attending the Lake Elsinore-San Jacinto Watershed Summit next week, but I will not be presenting. I'll be a cheerleader for our executive officer, but I'm looking forward to attending that. I had wanted to attend the last summit they had a couple years ago, but they had on the agenda the TMDLs that we wound up taking up about a year later. So hopefully there's nothing on the agenda there that's going to come before us in the near future. And then last of all, I want to encourage our board members to attend the Water Quality Control coordinating meeting next month in Sacramento. It's always a great and to attend in person. It's just a great opportunity to see the presentations. Our executive officer is going to be making a hearing on the highlights and accomplishments of this board. All of the boards are asked to do that, and it's very fascinating to see the kinds of issues that the other boards face. And then there's also an opportunity to interact with your fellow board members from the other regions during the breaks and for lunch and dinner. It's just a great opportunity every year. So with that, we are adjourned.